Meeting on healthcare reform. Today is Wednesday, March 7th. We apologize for the absence of our House colleagues. We know Senator Bates is wandering around here someplace aimlessly, hoping he's not lost. And we are very pleased this evening to have a presentation from the Oregon Health Policy Commission, which I sat on and Representative Greenlit sat on, as well as a number of highly qualified individuals, some of whom are here tonight, including the chair, Terry Barnett. So, are the mics on? Am I not getting? Well, we hope the tape got all that stuff. The real stuff's in the presentation. So, without further ado, let's have our guest representatives of the Oregon Health Policy Commission.
Okay. I just sat down.
Yeah.
You put it in front of me. I'll use it.
Committee, if we could hold our questions until they have a chance to make their presentation, we are capable of writing them down. Chair. You're supposed to be the chair.
Whatever. Yeah. Well, I was on the trap line to see if everybody was tonight. The entire House is tied up in negotiations over several contentious issues. Senator Morse is involved in those discussions. So we be it for tonight, I'm afraid. But we will carry the ball well and ask you difficult and biting questions at the end of your presentation so you know you've been heard. And we will share it with the rest of the committee when they're available.
It's quality, not quantity.
That's right. Very well put.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Westland, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kerry Barnett. I am here in my role as Chair of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. To my left is Gretchen Morley, who is our very, very able and capable Director of the Commission. We really appreciate the opportunity to present to you here today. We know that you should have in front of you a copy of our slides. More importantly, we know that over the last couple of days, each of you should have received a copy of our draft report. We're going to go through it at a pretty high level, but there are a lot of, I think, important details in there. And when you're talking about health care reform, the devil is always in the details. And so I would really hope that you get a chance to spend a little bit of time going through it. I wanted to begin very, very quickly, and we really will go through these slides at a pretty rapid pace. There it goes. We can slow down wherever you have questions at the end. Very briefly, I wanted to give a quick overview of the commission itself. It was established by the legislature in 2003, replacing the Oregon Health Council. You see there on the slide the 10 voting members, and I think you'll recognize at least several of those names. I think it's a pretty good cross-section of healthcare expertise in the state, and we have some, I think, pretty deep and meaningful discussions. We also have four legislators who are part of the commission. We have one vacancy right now. But you'll also recognize some of those names as well, Representative Greenlake and, of course, Senator Westland, who have been involved in our discussions all along the way. Our statutory purpose, I'm not going to go through this bullet by bullet. Suffice it to say that the purpose is very broad and that we've been charged with reviewing health policy issues and providing recommendations and advice to the legislature and to the governor. Our mission, again, I'll let you go through that on your own. It's really very broad. I don't think there are any surprises in there, but it's a reminder of how complex and broad this issue really is. From the very beginning, we identified some basic principles for improving our system. We developed some principles based on kind of what our vision was for healthcare. But these are principles relating to those areas where we think there are important pressure points or leverage points, where there's some real potential for making significant changes in the system. And again, I'm not going to go through it bullet by bullet, but I think those are It's a strong statement, and it's something that's withstood the test of time so far. And you'll be able to see a lot of those characteristics in the more detailed proposal that we'll be talking about here today. About a year ago, we received a formal charge from Governor Kulongoski, who asked us to spend some concentrated time to create a roadmap for reform for the state of Oregon, complete with some pretty concrete steps as to how we can get from the current system to a reformed and improved system. We were asked to put together recommendations that could be implemented over the near term, with the ultimate goal of being providing access for all Oregonians to affordable health care. And very specifically, the governor said to us, don't ignore the issue of sustainable financing. It's not just a matter of putting together the structure of an improved system. We have to also figure out how to finance it as well. For most of the last year, we've been working on that charge. The result is the report that you see in front of you. We began by putting together some principles relating to the task. The first is one that I know this committee shares, which is this notion of healthcare as a shared social responsibility. In other words, everybody's got to step up and make some changes and take on some responsibility if this system is going to work the way it should work. We decided that for us, near term meant a 5-year time horizon. In other words, we're looking for changes that can be made over the course of the next 5 years that will make very significant improvements in the system. We decided that it was important that we set out to support and improve the current programs and structures in our healthcare system that work, and then resolve to overhaul those that don't. So, we didn't start by throwing everything out the door. We said, let's kind of focus on the pieces that work, hang on to those, make sure we make the necessary adjustments. But those pieces that just don't work very well, let's get rid of those. The fourth bullet, I think, is very important. All too often, I think, there's a tendency to focus on access issues, trying to bring all those uninsured Oregonians into the system. And the reality is that access issues, cost, transparency, and quality issues are thoroughly intertwined, in that you really can't take on access unless you're also willing to focus on those other areas as well. It's important that we make rational coverage decisions, thoughtful, planful coverage decisions. And I think the best example of that is the prioritized list, something that we've sought to include in the plan. We sought to place highest priority on prevention, care management, and catastrophic care. Prevention, because that's where you get the biggest return on investment. Care management, particularly chronic disease care management, and catastrophic care, because those are huge cost drivers within the system today. We felt it was very necessary to encourage delivery system integration and to align payment incentives. The reality is that in today's system, all the payment incentives, conflict with our most fundamental goals in the healthcare system instead of aligning with those goals. We felt it was important to maximize available funding from whatever source, particularly federal Medicaid match dollars. And then finally, we recognized all along that there are a number of efforts underway relating to health care reform, and we have sought to coordinate and collaborate closely with those other efforts, to the point that at one point we sponsored a significant roundtable where we got a lot of people together to share ideas on what they were doing. Now let me move forward to talking about the recommendations themselves. These are the health reform recommendations. Starting out with number one, which is universal coverage for children. Not going to spend a lot of time on this. The governor obviously has a proposal out there that's being discussed widely throughout this building. Suffice it to say that the commission is supportive of that. We think it's a very important starting point. It's relatively inexpensive, and it's something I think important that we can take out of this legislative session. Number two is an individual coverage requirement. I'm going to go through these again very quickly, and then we're going to come back to them and go through them in a little bit more detail. This is essentially an individual mandate. But then, of course, we recognize that mandating that everybody goes out and gets coverage only works for those people who can afford the coverage, which leads us to a need for an expansion of public coverage programs, as well as subsidies for those, sliding scale subsidies for those who can't otherwise afford it. We are proposing this kind of this middle structure, kind of a market organizer, a market facilitator, an entity that will drive value into the marketplace. And we call it a health insurance exchange. In Massachusetts, they call it a connector. It has different names in different places, but we think it's an important kind of focal point for our recommendations. We talk about sustainable system financing. There is, in fact, a price tag that goes with this. If we want to bring 610,000+ Oregonians into the healthcare system, it's going to have a price tag associated with it. We think there are ways to mitigate that price tag, but I think we need to be willing to talk openly about how we would finance this. We're going to talk about broader delivery system reforms. This is recognizing that you can't just talk about access. You also have to talk about cost, efficiency, quality, and all those other sub-bullets that you see there, transparency, reimbursement reform, medical mistakes, those kinds of things. One of our recommendations focuses on providing broad support for community efforts to improve access and delivery. This is recognizing that there are a lot of good things going on relating to the delivery system on a local community level, and we think those have to be supported. And then ultimately, and this is something that frankly is missing from, I think, most reform recommendations, and that's a rigorous evaluation of the reforms. It involves planning that evaluation in advance, collecting the necessary data, and then doing the evaluation. Okay, let's go back through those with a little bit more detail, but again, we'll keep it moving pretty quickly. Starting with the individual coverage requirement, I don't think it's necessary to talk more about the kids' coverage. This is a requirement that everybody, every Oregonian, obtain affordable health insurance. What constitutes a qualifying health insurance policy? Something we discuss in some detail, and we decided that there should be a very broad definition as to what type of policy would qualify under the individual mandate. So if somebody wants to go out and get a policy, an HSA or a high deductible policy, that's their choice, we think that that should still qualify. The important thing is that everybody goes out there and makes a decision as to what coverage is best for them, and that they actually obtain that coverage. And in fact, non-participants would face penalties. Now, a lot of people talk about how this is similar to auto insurance, and the fact that with mandatory auto insurance, there's a fairly high rate of people who don't comply. We think the rate of compliance with the individual coverage requirement for health insurance would be substantially higher for two reasons. Number one, you have a Medicaid program. In other words, the poorest people out there have an ability to get that health insurance through a public program, something that isn't true with mandatory auto insurance. But more important, there would be an enforcement mechanism through state tax filings. And the penalty that would apply would be a loss of the individual income tax deduction. We think that having a mandate like this, it may seem a little heavy-handed. We think it really isn't, that there's substantial public benefit that arises from it. There's a benefit for the previously uninsured because they're obviously the ones who are getting new access to health care and hopefully better health outcomes as a result. There's a very substantial benefit for people who are currently insured because it would significantly reduce the cost shift that results from all the uncompensated care that's received by people who are currently uninsured. And then a benefit for society at large because basically everybody's playing, you have a healthier pool, and it just makes a lot more sense. The next area that we talk about is public coverage and subsidies. Again, just mandating that everybody go out and get health insurance isn't enough. You have to recognize that some people are going to need help being able to afford that coverage. Our proposal is to expand the Oregon Health Plan up to 200% federal poverty level. Adults with employer-sponsored coverage who are under 200% would be required to take advantage of that employer-sponsored coverage. Doing the expansion of the Oregon Health Plan, we think, can be done in a way that will maximize the federal match dollars, something that is very important to making the system financially sustainable. And then for those who would not qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, we propose sliding scale premium subsidies up to 300% of the federal poverty level. The subsidies, as you can see, would be based on affordability, there would be a minimum benefit plan that would be devised by the health insurance exchange that would take advantage of the prioritized list, because we talked about making rational coverage decisions. The health insurance exchange, as I mentioned, is a very important component of this. We think of it as being a market organizer, a central forum for the buying and selling of health insurance. In particular, we think it would focus on providing value to individuals and small employers. These are the folks who I think have the most trouble navigating their way through the health insurance purchasing system today. The exchange, we believe, could provide a mechanism for the pre-tax purchasing of health insurance for individuals, something that today in the current market, individuals who go out in the market aren't able to do. The exchange would also be the entity that creates access to public subsidies for individuals who meet the income requirements. We see the exchange as a smart purchaser that can help drive value-based purchasing. It can create incentives, whether it's carrots or sticks, on the part of the health insurers and providers relating to payment incentives, cost control, care management, and a host of other things. The exchange would define that affordability standard that we talked about a minute ago relating to the subsidies. And would act very similar to the way PEB acts today in terms of defining some of those insurance packages that would be available for purchase through the exchange. Here's a schematic that kind of captures how the exchange would work. You see the premium subsidies going in from the bottom. Buyers, including employers and individuals, would go to the exchange to seek information and purchasing opportunities, purchasing choices. And then the various sellers, including HMOs, PPOs, and so on, would essentially respond to RFPs from the exchange and hope to get included as one of the offerings of the exchange. The exchange would not be required to offer dozens and dozens of policies. We would expect the exchange to play the role of sifting through the offerings in the private market and figuring out which ones make the most sense. And that's the way that we think that it could help drive real value, drive real benefit. We do not see the exchange as being mandatory. It's mandatory only for individuals who are accessing the premium subsidies. That's the door you need to go in order to get the subsidies. But other than that, it would be voluntary. If you wanted to go to the internet to purchase insurance, you could. If you wanted to go directly to the carrier, you could. If you wanted to go to your agent and get help from your agent, you can do that too. We believe the key is for the exchange to figure out how to drive value into the system. We believe it can, and if it can, if in fact it can, we believe that people will obviously prefer to come to it instead of going elsewhere to purchase insurance. The benefits of an exchange, it's something that would be sustainable over time. It would offer a variety of product options. As I said before, it would facilitate a pre-tax purchase of health insurance by individuals. It would reduce the administrative burden for small businesses. These are small businesses that don't have an HR department. They don't have an ability to go out and do a bunch of research necessarily. They're too busy running their businesses. And we think that the exchange would essentially act as the market organizer and the information provider for those kinds of businesses. As I said before, that voluntary use, it would be the way that individuals would access subsidies. Very important. We think that the exchange will help increase portability for individuals. So if a small employer, if you're employed by a small employer who acquires insurance through the exchange, and then you change employers, very likely you would have the opportunity to continue with your existing coverage through the exchange, thereby essentially making it portable from employer to employer. And then there would also be an important pooling function that the exchange would provide, something that you don't necessarily get when you're purchasing insurance as an individual. I've touched on this already, but the exchange would be able to take advantage of certain cost containment tools relating to benefit design, placing expectations on insurance carriers, and frankly, we see the exchange as having a significant amount of clout in the marketplace. So we believe that insurance carriers would, in fact, be responsive to those requests. And it would also act as a smart buyer using value-based purchasing. In terms of how it would be administered, we see it as a public-private hybrid structure. We don't see it as being strictly a governmental entity, nor do we see it as being entirely private. We see it as some sort of a hybrid run by a board of directors that would have some level of public oversight. It would need to be financially sustainable, meaning it would need to generate its own funding internally. Sources could include some sort of a transaction fee whenever somebody purchases insurance through the exchange, a membership fee, even a slight surcharge on policy, something of that sort. System financing is the next component. As I said, there is a price tag to this. Our preliminary estimates, based on the best data, the modeling data that we could come up with, is that the expansion of the Oregon Health Plan and the premium subsidies would come to about $550 million a year, about $1.1 billion a biennium. We understand that that's a significant price tag, but the reality is if we're going to bring 600,000 people into this system, there's going to be a price tag associated with it. That $550 million does include covering kids, so it's not in addition to any sort of a kids program. Very, very important, though, we think that there are significant economic benefits that flow back into the system as a result of this. So even though there's $550 million a year going out, a significant amount will be coming back through a reduction in the cost shift, as we talked about a little bit earlier. And we're also very interested in driving additional system efficiencies. Gretchen is going to talk about this in just a minute. And we think there will be real opportunities to arrive at savings through those efficiencies. It can be a real challenge, however, to find those efficiencies in the system and to gather together those dollars in order to use to provide the subsidies. So the system, those system savings, we believe, will essentially help offset some of the inflation in the healthcare system, as opposed to really being easily extracted in order to pay the price tag. We believe that this requires a broad-based financing mechanism. We discuss a payroll assessment in the report. Our notion is that a payroll assessment should recognize the fact that some employers are already paying out a significant amount of money providing health care coverage for their employees. And so we believe there should be an offset against any assessment to recognize those folks who are paying the money out already. And then there are also other funding options discussed in the report. I won't go into that detail right now, however. And I will turn it over to Gretchen.
There. Again, my name is Gretchen Morley, Director of the Health Policy Commission. I am going to provide some additional highlights of what you'll find in the report. I'm not going to go recommendation by recommendation. I do urge you to look through it. As an intro, this slide, you'll see throughout the report, we reference a high-value affordable health care system. And we do that, and it's defined by those four bullets up there, by affordable access, high-quality, coordinated, and safe care, efficient evidence-based care, and continuous system improvement, to keep on the table throughout the report that it means more than access to reform the system. I'm going to provide some highlights of what we mean or what we propose to address some of those bullets. Carrie already covered, mentioned how, say, the proposals around the exchange, how the public subsidies are used, can get at a lot of these as well. I'm going to hit them at a high level. One, because you've heard some of these already. Vicki Gates was here several weeks ago and gave you some proposals on transparency, and Jody Pettit was here as well on electronic health records. And we're also pleased that a lot of the similar ideas or the same ideas that are in the HPC report are incorporated in a lot of the recent documents that this committee is looking at. So there's quite a bit of overlap. In terms of healthcare quality, these are the things that you did hear from Vicki before. In terms of creating a quality institute, a form of a public-private collaborative effort that would improve the availability of information, the collection of that information, public reporting from all sectors across the healthcare system. The commission did envision this as coordinating, but set up outside the exchange as an entity that would include all sectors. The recommendation itself in the report actually recommends bringing partners together to develop the right collaborative model to make this work, and that everybody is contributing to this model so the transparency is pushed forward in the state. Value-based purchasing is highlighted in the report with a number of recommendations, particularly pushing the fact that the state can be quite a leader in this area, whether it's through PEB, Public Employees Benefit Board, or whether it's through entities like the Exchange or the entity that this committee is talking about. There's a lot of options there and a lot of opportunity. In terms of improving the system and care quality, this is somewhat a continuation of the previous slide. You heard from Jody Pettit on electronic health records, the importance of statewide leadership and coordination. Privacy and security are obviously paramount in terms of interoperability of sharing information, and any kind of support for pilot projects to push, pilot programs to push electronic health records forward is obviously would be a good thing. In terms of improving collaboration and state leadership for healthcare safety, the commission has several recommendations supporting the work of the Patient Safety Commission, encouraging participation from providers outside of in addition to hospitals to the commission's voluntary reporting program would be one of those steps. In terms of improving access and delivery, I know many of you are familiar with some of the work that's going on both within the safety net world as well as local communities. And there's the issue of promoting a primary care medical home model is one that the commission supports. There's a legislation, Senate Bill 562, that is promoting this goal as well. There's also another bill in House Bill 3250 in terms of supporting local community-created solutions, and one such as Lane County 100% Access Project. These are communities that are looking to align their local resources, and the Commission feels strongly that state policy needs to recognize those and support those local solutions. In terms of the last bullet there on realigning system incentives to create a high-value healthcare system, I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in just a couple more slides, but the idea that the system incentives need to be changed. Everybody talks about it. The Commission's very interested in looking at very specific ways that can be done, and that clearly local activities going on around collaboration and access need to be involved in that discussion about realigning incentives. We have a highlight section in the report on public health and health reform. at several points in time, we mentioned putting a high priority on prevention services. Clearly, from the health care side, there should be the realigning payment incentives to encourage prevention and better care management. But also the issue of integrating the public health system and healthcare systems. The local collaboratives are an ideal place for that kind of collaboration to go on. But there really is potential for the two systems to work together on issues around disease prevention and effective care management. So the report does urge that, and state policy that's passed that highlights that would further this effort. Carrie mentioned the value of a well-thought-out, well-planned evaluation plan. I think one thing we would highlight that components should include a well-planned baseline data collection and planning to make sure that we have the well-thought-out plan from the start versus looking back and trying to figure out what data we can use to evaluate. The commission envisioned the evaluation being an independent evaluator that provides the legislature, the governor, other stakeholders, unbiased reporting and analysis. And the commission does recommend capitalizing on some of the current infrastructure, which would be somehow in coordination with the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research and the Oregon Health Research Evaluation Collaborative, which includes researchers from across Oregon. And then there's several points about what an evaluation proposal should assess. Many of these points are included in some of the recent documents I've seen this committee evaluating or reviewing. So, and like I said, there's many more details around those recommendations in the report, and I do encourage you to look into them further. In terms of next steps for the HPC, as I mentioned, there's a real interest in looking at the delivery system. I think the way to characterize it is the commission is very interested in going to the next level down from the report, really looking at what the current incentives are in the system and what would be the recommendations to change those incentives. And few of the goals around that effort would be encouraging the most effective care in the most appropriate setting, putting that emphasis on prevention, chronic care management, encouraging health information technology and interoperability, provider capacity, and integrating cost containment in any system reforms that are passed. So the idea is getting to the specifics and being able to pass them back to whatever reform discussions are going on at the time, and in both public and private. And just as a last note, we will be inviting public input on the HPC report. There's in the handouts, there's the link for providing input and my contact information if anybody has questions.
Well, thank you both very much. Carrie, thank you for coming on this evening, and Gretchen, too. I appreciate the efforts you did to coordinate all the last year with what your health policy commission was doing and what the special commission on access and affordability for the Senate was doing. And I also appreciate you were kind enough to give me a draft of this about 2 or 3 weeks ago, which I read carefully. And I was struck by tonight's presentation and in the previous draft I'd seen more by the commonness in the two plans than by the exceptions between them. And in many places, it's just a matter, I think, of verbiage between the two of them. It's amazing that two groups focusing on the same problems basically end up in the same place in many, many ways. There are some differences, and I'm sure there will be questions tonight about those differences. But we'll get into those, but I want to tell you we appreciate both coming down tonight and a good report. I really think it's got a lot of interesting ideas in it. So, which to me, we don't have in Senate Bill 27, and we don't see in Senate Bill 329, and we probably should have a discussion about those two. Okay. So, with that, I would open up to questions from the committee. Senator.
Actually, a comment, Mr. Chair, and that is, I know you've been saying this, I've been saying this, we have four very sincere, forthright, well-constructed plans out there, and it just, I think, goes to show the severity and depth of the crisis that individual plans coming from independent sources are A, surfacing at the same time, and B, share so much in common. Certainly differences, and those differences are the challenge of this committee to put the best ideas in all the bills to bring forth the best public policy for Oregon. I mean, no one has a monopoly on good ideas, and this is not about who's right, it's about what's right for Oregon. So we very, very, very much appreciate you being here this evening and participating fully in this process. Not to help the committee, to help Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator.
Thank you. I spoke with you this morning because I was so impressed with this. I received it yesterday. I had no idea. I didn't see
Bill,
it.
Bill, grab your mic.
I'm sorry. Gretchen, I didn't see an earlier copy of this, and it kind of blew me away because we've been talking about a lot of things that didn't really come together, and this does. And so I'm very optimistic, and I'm hoping that we can integrate our vagueness with your plan. Before I make people mad, I'll end it.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just make a comment. First of all, I appreciate your comments. And Gretchen and I did a radio interview just yesterday, I think it was, and one of the questions was, golly, it seems like there are all these different health care reform proposals being considered in the legislature. Isn't this really a problem? And our response was, no, I mean, it would be a horrible problem if there weren't that many reform proposals being discussed in this building. And that I think the process that you're all going through right now is really to collate them into one that that really has legs and that can really work. We tried to emphasize that we don't see these proposals as competing with one another, but rather essentially complementing one another. I just want to say that the Oregon Business Council, which of course is one of those four entities that has put forward a plan, I think the OBC proposal is particularly similar to what you've heard tonight. What you've been discussing in this committee over the course of the last couple of months, I think there are also some very important similarities. The key question, I think, is figuring out what exactly is the role of the exchange, what exactly is the role and the function of the entity, as you call it, because, as I said earlier, I think really the devil is in the details of figuring out what authority it has, how it would operate, and that's going to take some very detailed thinking. We are very eager to engage with this body in beginning to delve into that level of detail as well.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Ramon Anderson.
On page 3, first of all, it seems like we're just going over and over the same thing. I just so think this is wonderful work. I think 329 is good. We're getting to a place, and I think the Archimedes one format and infrastructure is so good. But on page 3, charge from the governor, says roadmap for reform with concrete steps. Where are you? That's where I want to go. I want to have concrete steps. And are you going to be working with us to share those concrete steps, or are you going to be going into on another figuring out your own concrete steps that the governor needs to have done?
I think there needs to be kind of a sequencing of what happens from here. And I know you've been carving out a very important process as you've kind of gotten you've sunk your wrists and arms into these issues. You know, I think the first thing that needs to occur is the various organizations that have put forward these proposals need to kind of arrive at some sort of an understanding as to what the basic structure is of the plan. You know, how are we going to think of this exchange entity or whatever we're going to call it? And then I think once we have that, what really needs to occur is for some real detail level work to be done. Because as long as this report is, and as much, I believe, real nuts and bolts substance is in here, it's really just a starting point. There's a lot of detail that still needs to be carved out, and that's true of all of the proposals, as we all know, that are being considered in this building. So we would love to work with you kind of as part of a design team of sorts to really get into that level of detail, using a structure that I think you need to settle on. Part of that design team work needs to involve figuring out kind of a step-by-step approach of how you phase this in. There are very significant transitional issues, for example. There are timing issues. There are financing issues. And all of them, I think, really require a level of expertise applied that frankly hasn't been yet. So I think that there's a sequencing as to how it all needs to be approached.
Mr. Chair, can I comment on that?
Yes, and then Gretchen.
Let me share for you an answer to that question, which is House Bill 3368, and it was my attempt to convert it was our legislative council's attempt to convert the report of the commission into a legislative proposal. And I'm fully prepared to have some, if you'd like a copy of those. Fully prepared to begin to discuss this specifically in the House Committee or do it as a part of our deliberations here, but I felt it was necessary, as I stated actually in the Commission on several occasions, to produce a legislative proposal out of that report that was an attempt to convert the report into a proposal. So this has had a first reading. I assume it will be assigned to the House Committee on Health Care, and this is an attempt to put this into the mix along with the Archimedes. What's it? Senate Bill 27?
27.
Senate Bill 27 and Senate Bill 329 and a bill Representative Richardson is going to have as well that represents his view of where to move forward. And I'm sorry I'm late and I need to leave again. We're in recess on the floor.
I understand you're in turmoil, so I appreciate you even coming.
In total turmoil.
I appreciate you even taking the time to come down this evening. Gretchen?
Just really quickly, I wanted to also offer up what is another resource. When I was highlighting what the HPC is doing next, I should have also mentioned that the HPC, along with the Northwest Health Foundation all year, has been providing a venue for many of the groups that are interested in pushing reform, working on reform throughout the year to keep people in communication. And I think that's been a very rewarding group, and that group will continue to be meeting and can be a resource to these efforts as well in terms of reaching consensus on ideas. And all of you actually should have received a consensus statement that was developed by that reform group in the mail. And I believe you received it both electronically and in your inboxes. So just something I wanted to highlight as a resource to the committee.
Carrie, just a couple comments from me if I could. First off, I want to ask you about two things, but the thing you call an exchange, the thing we've called an entity, and people call it various things in various bills, this, I believe, is what you're correct in saying, is the key to how we're going to get there, if we're going to get there at all. The authority and responsibilities of that entity or exchange is the key to this. When I look through your report, and I earmarked thoughts and things that were in 329, I found everything in your report in 329 already, except for the assessment plan, which I thought was a nice addition. Are we really getting anywhere? How do we assess that? That was not in 329. We need to put that in there. The question I have for you first is, on the exchange, your first description of exchange was, it's a facilitator to get people into insurance programs. But as I read through the rest of your report, there's obviously a desire here to bring in other pieces to this. Transferability, ability to see more clearly what those plans are offering. There's issues about financial benefits and whatnot and the benefit plans itself. One point speaks to using the Health Service Commission, other catastrophic, maybe catastrophic combined with preventative. Mm-hmm. You see the exchange doing more than just being a facilitator and the overall picture. Do you see it as an entity that will do more than that?
I do. with obviously limitations. I think that it's important to give the exchange certain authority. It needs to have pooling authority. It needs to have this ability to generate its own funding. It needs to have authority, I believe, to offer pre-tax coverage. I think that's very important. That's a very important value add into the system. And I think there are two or three others that escape me right now. As I said earlier, we do see it being important that the exchange is essentially a voluntary mechanism, that it needs to prove its value to the marketplace, that it's very different from creating a sort of a single purchasing entity for all health insurance, which we think by establishing the exchange as a voluntary mechanism, that it needs to prove itself every day out there in the marketplace. We think that it would still leave open all kinds of opportunities for innovation and creativity out there in the marketplace, which is very different from a notion that all innovation really needs to get fed through this central exchange, this central entity. So, you know, frankly, Chairman Bates, these are the critical issues, kind of figuring out exactly what authority and what expectations we would have of this central entity. As you can imagine, there are stakeholders out there who get pretty nervous about this. You know, they get nervous that it's going to be too powerful, that it's not going to be powerful enough, that it's going to focus its stare on them instead of the other guy. And, you know, this is just part of the complexity of this system that we have. I think if it's going to work, if it's going to be successful, we've really got to vet these issues. We've got to get some pretty good definition around what this central entity can and would do, and that's just a really critical first step.
Thank you. And just to respond to that, in 329, the entity would still leave open the possibility for individuals or companies to be either self-insured or to purchase directly from an accountable health plan. They don't have to go through the entity. And so that there's a similarity there from what you're speaking to also. The other thing I noted in this, I didn't see you speak very clearly to tax deductibility or a pre-tax situation other than what you just said now. And neither did I see you address the issue of Medicare here. We've chosen in 329 not to address those. Senate Bill 27 does. Do you have any comments on that?
We don't address Medicare. And the reason why is because it's a federal program. We felt that it probably didn't come under the charge that we received from the governor to focus on some near-term reforms that can be achieved primarily in this building. If I can throw in an editorial comment, we can't solve this problem of health care in Oregon alone. We know that, and it's for two reasons. Number one, the single largest purchaser of health insurance by far is the federal government. So much of the financing and purchasing decisions that are made by the federal government drive the market realities here in Oregon, that you can't really get your arms around the entire system without dealing with the federal approach. And we commend former Governor Kitzhaber for the approach that he's taken. We think it's a longer-term approach, and while we're struggling with that whole issue of congressional politics, we think there are a lot of things that we can do right here in Oregon, and that's what you see here in this report. The other thing that we need to bear in mind is that people move very freely from state to state, so we have to just be mindful of that as we carve out certain benefits within the system here in Oregon, because I think there really is an issue related to people moving around and creating some adverse selection. I don't think that should necessarily be a checkmate for us as we move forward with some of these things, but I guess my summary is there's a lot that we can do on our own in this building, and we think we should move forward with that.
Other questions? I'm sorry, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The concept of a health care or health exchange, has that been tried anywhere in the world which you're aware of?
The short answer is not yet. It's being put together in Massachusetts. They passed their legislation, if I recall, last spring, about a year ago, and they've been working on implementation over the course of the last year, and I believe it goes into effect on either June 1st or July 1st. But they're still working on a lot of their details.
Thank you.
Raise your hand. The chair reluctantly recognizes Senator Westland.
Kerry, I've heard Peggy Fowler and Mark McMullen and even Bill Cramer use this term value-based purchasing. Could you define that for me in simple, single-syllable word language so even I can understand that?
I'll take a swing at it. We have a couple definitions in the report. When we talk about value-based purchasing, I believe when everybody talks about value-based purchasing is incorporating to the extent possible incentives, motivators, things that will improve the quality, the health outcomes that's being purchased with the healthcare dollar. So I'm sure somebody else could probably give a more eloquent definition of that, but it's really purchasing with the mindset of driving value and health outcomes in the system.
So, okay, how do you achieve that?
Well, we have a number of recommendations in the report. The work that PEB has been doing is a good example locally of trying to push that in the Public Employees Benefit Program. I think some examples of chronic care management in the Medicaid program. It can come from a number of directions.
So there's lots of little variables in this equation that equals value-based purchasing.
That would be my understanding. I think it's also a mindset from the purchaser side.
And how much of that is consumer, I, the holder of the policy, versus commercially, the issuer of the policy or the payer of the policy? How much... Is it both sides of that?
I would say it's both, and I think some of it is giving both the purchasers and the consumer the tools, having the transparency of information, having the information at the point of decision making, to be able to make educated choices in healthcare.
So the biggest driver to get to this is as transparent a system as possible, arming the consumer and the payer with as much information, or at least access to as much information as they can possibly get to make a value-based purchase. Is that?
I think that's a major element. Like I said, I'm sure that there's some others, even probably in this room, that could talk about this more eloquently. But yes, a major element would be transparency of information.
Okay.
I've got a few more questions, if I might. You talk about...
Raise your hand.
I don't have to. Sure tonight. Tomorrow or not, you can do it. You talk about changing incentives. I mean, we all are talking about primary care home. We're talking about managing chronic disease. Institute of Medicine feels that's the direction we have to go to get affordable health care. What kind of incentives are you thinking about changing? Have you driven to that detail yet?
We're actually, if you look at the Commission's work plan over the next several months, we're focusing on exactly those issues relating to incentives in the system. Certainly payment incentives is critical, but those aren't the only ones. You get into issues relating to defensive medicine, for example. The bottom line relating to incentives is that if you look at the behavior of all of the actors in the healthcare system, talking about insurers, hospitals, providers, individual patients, government, everybody. If you look at the way they behave, I believe they behave in an absolutely rational way. Rational in the sense that there are certain incentives that they have and certain interests that they have, and their behavior very closely tracks those incentives and those interests. So you have all this rational behavior. The problem is you then look at everybody's behavior together as a healthcare system, and it's a completely irrational system. So you've got rational behavior, irrational system. I believe that if we're going to change the system, there's some things that we really can do through legislative fiat. But there are so many behavioral changes out there that we can't accomplish through mere legislative fiat. What we have to do is change those incentives, because people will always act based on the incentives that they're subject to. And again, there's nobody in the system, I think, who isn't subject to this. What we're beginning to do at the commission is to look at very specific behavior out there in the system that leads to bad outcomes, and then doing some analysis to say, what are the incentives that create that behavior? And then the next step is to say, what's the behavior we would prefer, and what incentives could create or lead to that behavior? The classic one, of course, I think, relates to provider reimbursement. You know, we pay providers today primarily on a fee-for-service basis. And I think it's a real stretch to believe that fee-for-service payments create the kinds of incentives that lead to the goals that I think we all share relating to the healthcare system. So we need to think about, are there better ways? Are there better incentives out there? Maybe it's a different way of casting fee-for-service medicine, whatever it might be. But that's the level at which I think we need to focus if we're going to really make those behavioral changes occur.
Hey, Carrie, that leads to my next question. Let's say you identify the incentives you want to check, because, you know, Ben Wesley has mentioned many times the market is working perfectly, and I think he's absolutely right. For the incentives built into this market is working perfectly. It is designed to do exactly what it's doing. We aren't getting what we want because we've not designed it right. I couldn't agree with both of you more. Let's say you find out full incentive changes you want to make. How do you make the change? How do you get those incentives changed? I mean, do you use your exchange to use that? Do you set up a board to do that? How do you plan, once you've identified those things, to make those changes occur?
I think that's the $64 billion question.
Or in the state, $17 billion a year question.
It's how you get. I mean, we all have the sense of what's wrong with the system. We all have the sense of what we'd like the system to look like. The key question is how you get from here to there. I think some of those changes require legislation. You know, if you're relating to the creation of an exchange, relating to giving it certain elements of authority, relating to creating a subsidy program and other things. So that's one level. I think that there are collaborations that can occur between insurers and hospitals, insurers and providers, hospitals and providers, everybody and patients, that can be put into place that frankly can't be done through legislative fiat, but can be done when you have kind of willing people who are willing to get on the same page. And I think we've seen in this state some good examples of some of those collaborations occurring on a local level. I think we need to figure out how to support that kind of activity. And then there's a third level of activity that frankly, it can be accomplished sometimes indirectly. For example, if we significantly increase the transparency of the system so that the way each actor behaves is readily apparent to everyone, whether it's pricing decisions or quality of outcomes or treatment decisions, whatever it might be, if all of that information is made freely available in a transparent way, I think that will help lead to a realignment of some of these incentives. So I think it's a multi headed beast, and we need to take a lot of different types of approaches. But we need to begin by kind of cataloging what are the incentives that need to get changed and how are we going to change each one of those. I think it requires a lot of heavy lifting and a whole lot of collaboration on the part of all the people involved.
Thank you. I've got two last ones to let you out of here, okay? I want to congratulate you first on two pieces of this report that I thought took a lot of courage. One was talking for the first time openly about an individual mandate. That takes a certain amount of courage. And in Section 7, your Recommendation 7, you talk about essentially producing a funding source for this that talks about everybody getting into it, all employers, all employees. That took a lot of courage, too. The details of that you left wisely vague, but I'd like to hear a little more from you if you feel comfortable talking about it.
Well, let's let Mitch talk about that. He's got it in his bill.
I have an excise tax and a payroll tax.
Exactly.
Have an excise tax and a what?
Payroll tax.
Let's let Mitch talk about it.
That's what I thought was in the report, and that's the way that it came out. I think it's time we begin discussing. The thing that the report started in the very first session of the report was the concept that providing health insurance is a shared responsibility. I mean, and that it's got to be shared by everybody. And that's where the notion of both an individual mandate and an employer mandate, I think, came out of the very first meeting. Once you start with that shared by everybody, you start asking somebody, what does that mean? It means everybody has to pay some to be a part of that system. And that leads you to a payroll tax. There's an amount in here that I think is perhaps inadequate, but at least it allows us to begin the discussion, to say the word, and to start talking about what that ultimately means. And this is modeled after what we perceive was the Massachusetts plan, but with some improvements. I just think the commission report, let me say, I think the commission report is wonderful. The only place that...
Were you on that commission?
Yes.
Oh.
But where I parted with the commission in the third meeting from the end, was I thought the commission needed to create a legislative piece. The report and a legislative piece that went with it. And the commission didn't feel comfortable moving in that direction. And then I thought, well, that's all right. They're not legislators. That's not what they do. So I thought, okay, we'll try. And I'm not sure what we have in 3368 is an exact. I mean, you know, this is Lori Freeman working hard to see as the report changes how that would convert into a legislative proposal. But I wanted to make sure that when, with an answer to Lori's question, what's the next step? I wanted to make sure that when we were thinking about 329 and 27 and whatever else comes along, that we had some beginning expression of this report. And this report, frankly, talked about payroll taxes. So here it is. We have a chance to talk about it. And we haven't talked about a payroll tax to pay for health care before, and this is a pretty modest tax.
I think that... Senator Morse? What's that?
Yeah, thank you. We're going to go to Lane... I will be in Lane County on Thursday evening, and we will hear from 100% Access, and I have said all along that we need to take a look at some of what's going on. They have a lot of volunteers. They try to provide dental coverage free to people who need it, and they're, you know, looking for dentists to volunteer, and they're having some success. And so my feeling is that it's a collaboration of what's out there right now that will make any plan successful, and it goes beyond just the repayments. It goes into community pride and development, and we take models of what works in various places, and then we look at how that might work in a part of the state that doesn't have the capacity and try to replicate and put extra resources in there. But this, I really like your report. I've read 329. I haven't read Mitch's yet. but I think yours has some very positive suggestions, and particularly now these guys are going out on the road and they're going to get that kind of input, and they'll see, you know, what the concerns are of people who are, I met, you know, this morning with LIPA, and they said, we want to know what's going on. We don't know for sure what's going on. It's the uncertainty. They have some ideas. They'll be there tomorrow night. And I think that's what's going to make a successful plan is the collaboration and the willingness of people to make it work and to sacrifice and to give some of their time as they're doing right now. So now I guess the implementation year one is the children's plan, if we can pass that. How realistically, how far away do you think we are? We're going to pass a bill this session, and that bill should then put us into the year two. How do you see our progress?
They're referring to the timeline.
Yeah. Well, I think it depends.
Well, year one is the legislative authorization of the children's plan. Year two, startup presentation, implementation, planning, design, and so on. So year two, according to your... No, that's still year one. Health insurance exchange operation in year two.
Right.
So have you looked at... Oh, okay.
3368 starts about 2010.
So is this a realistic...
If we had our druthers in the ideal world, what we would love to see come out of this legislative session would be the creation of the kids program, which we think is very attainable. And
I'm glad you think so, but then go ahead.
All right.
Well, we're...
And a clear process for creating the exchange with a target date somewhere around probably right about 2010 for it to go into effect along with the subsidy program, the OHP expansion, and the other pieces. But again, I know I'm repeating myself. There's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done at the detail level. And, we would love to work with you to begin that work starting now. And I think that's going to lead to an assessment as to whether or not it's realistic to create this entity, exchange, whatever it might be, whether to create it this session or whether to merely create a process that would lead to those decisions as to exactly what authority this entity would have and then create it next session.
Okay. May I ask one more question? I think that the next month will be very important, and Senators Bates and Westland are going to go out and make a number of visits around. And I, to the depth of my soul, believe that the success of this plan depends on the reception at the local level, and if people get excited and if people are willing to help and make suggestions and cooperate, that's more than half the battle, because we can't do something up here and then say, oh, by the way, you know, this is what's going to happen to you guys. So I think they're doing exactly the right thing, getting out there and meeting people and explaining and listening.
Support a road plan, a roadmap that one got the children's plan through this session, which is going to be difficult, but I think ultimately will happen one way or the other. At the same time, the initiation of the entity that would not only do the things you've talked about, being exchange, but also would do the really heavy lifting, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, over the next 8, 9, 10 months to really nail down these things, a great deal of them at least, so that when we came back in session, we'd be ready to talk about a payroll tax, a way of funding this, so that we'd have ability to take care of the 600,000 people who are uninsured, do it through Medicaid match as much as possible, fee out plan as much as possible, other supplements that might make this work.
Just so that I understand your question, the question would be, would it be possible to create this entity with the sole purpose of developing the details of the system? So you wouldn't actually be authorizing it to do anything beyond to come back to this body with a detailed plan. Is that
would be the minimum that would do. I would like to see it do more than that, frankly. I'd like to see it start to function. Okay. Start to have some ability to do some real work on the ground. Give it the authority to start being exchanged.
Yeah. The piece of that I struggle with, Mr. Chairman, is I think it's going to create some consternation on the part of a lot of stakeholders if what you wind up doing is creating an entity and then giving it the authority to determine what its authority is going to be.
It would have to come back to get any greater authority. That wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah. I mean, as I've said, I think the devil is in the details. And when you go out over the next several weeks and talk to members of the public, if you talk to people at the level of principal, you're going to get 100% positive reception. If you talk to people at a mid-level of detail, I think you're going to get 99% positive reception. The devil is in the real details as people try to figure out how is this really going to work and what's it really going to mean for my benefits and what's really going to be expected of me and who's going to pay for this. If I'm a small business owner, I'm really interested in that question. You know, if there's a payroll tax lurking out there, I think stakeholders get very nervous about approving something in a piecemeal fashion as opposed to seeing what the whole thing is really looks like at a level of detail to determine whether it's something that's palatable. That I think is the challenge that we all have as we figure out how to sequence this and move it forward.
Thank you. Further questions?
Yeah, question.
Yes.
Audience participation is, you know, encouraged. Did we get through, I say this in the best spirit of collegiality, did we get through the whole damn committee meeting without the word rural being mentioned?
Just
we didn't? That's good. I just want to make sure we're consistent in certain things.
Are they going to go to rural Oregon?
Yeah.
Good. We mentioned it twice.
Thank you for your time again. I should announce, I believe next week we're starting public testimony. We're opening up the public testimony next week, and we'll be posting out so you know the times and places, which will be here at the usual times and places. Adjourned.